This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week is our first in a two-part series on gender relating to mental health. And it's a special series we're doing relating to World Mental Health Day, which is this Saturday, the 10th of October. A date that, not for nothing, I also love because whether you're in the UK or whether you're in the States, it's still 10-10.
I didn't realise that.
That's the kind of thing I'm like really clued into because I think it's interesting, but also it's really handy. There's a tip if you're ever doing a contract with someone internationally and they put their months and their days the other way around, you just choose a date where it's the same.
The same.
Because then it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a brilliant tip. I remember that.
There's a really niche contract tip for you. What people are tuning in for, tips around signing contracts in the States. All right, so we'll start off with the definition because we're talking all about gender and actually it's a term that can sometimes be confused or misused. There is an important distinction between when we talk about gender and when we talk about biological sex, but oftentimes those can be used interchangeably, which kind of confuses things. So we've got some background on that from Wikipedia. Gender is the range of characteristics pertaining to and differentiating between masculinity and femininity. Depending on the context, these characteristics may include biological sex, sex-based social structures, i.e. gender roles, or gender identity. Most cultures use a gender binary, having two genders, i.e. boys/men and girls/women. Those who exist outside of these groups fall under the umbrella term non-binary or genderqueer. Some societies have specific genders besides man and woman, such as the Hijras of South Asia. These are often referred to as third genders or fourth genders, etc. Sexologist John Money introduced the terminology distinction between biological sex and gender as a role in 1955. Before his work, it was uncommon to use the word gender to refer to anything but grammatical categories. So what's meant by that is when you use gendering in language. In our language, we don't use it as much as some others. So in French, for example, a book is masculine in the way it's described and a chair is feminine, for example. And so generally, when the term gender was used before 1955, it was to do with that. Or to talk about like gendered titles like Mr. and Mrs. in the written word. So it's one of these therefore complicated things that, of course, we've now ended up with differences in how different generations look at what gender means, because it's not that long ago that term was hardly even used to describe people and how people identify. And the reason this is all relevant to today's conversation is because that's the side we'll be talking about. So we'll be talking about gender in terms of the kind of expectations that can be put on your gender identity. So for example, we often talk about on the podcast the idea of man up culture or boys don't cry is a clear example, which doesn't actually relate to biology. You know, of course I can cry, but I might be less expected to cry. Have I explained that well?
Absolutely brilliantly.
Oh, good. It's a weird thing to describe.
Well, it is. And normally when we give a definition on the show, it's a lot quicker than that. Mm. We might have a couple of sentences and that just goes to show, I guess, one, how far we've come, but also what we really need to understand when we talk about gender. Hearing you, my first reaction, Bob, is the fact, you know, I'm just really pleased, actually, that we have, you know, since 1955, we've come on so far and that we're having these conversations and there's actually words and language that we can use to talk about gender. There's so much more on offer now that represents our human race. And I think that would be my first response to that, which is fantastic.
Mm. And it's really important to have this kind of specific language because a lot of the specific areas of stigma that relate to gender are based on these expectations mm-hmm. of what it is to be a man, a woman, or identify outside of that, and not actually related to biology. And of course, many of the stats, as we'll establish going on, are more to do with stereotypes than they are with the actual reality of certain conditions and who they do or don't affect.
100%.
So on that note, let's get into some of them. I will shuffle my papers like a good little newsreader. So first off, from the Mental Health Foundation, in England, women are twice as likely as men to have a common mental health problem and are almost twice as likely to be diagnosed with anxiety disorders.
Oh, yeah. During all the research, really, I just keep coming back to, maybe because I'm, I guess, at heart a scientist, but I keep coming back to the whole, that question, why, you know, I just want to delve into it so much more. And I think it, as you carry on reading and the more we think and talk about this, it really will align with what you just said before around biology / environmental and social expectations. Like, really? Are women really biologically determined to experience anxiety more than men? Or are there many other factors that actually contribute to that?
Yeah.
That have nothing to do with biology and hormones, inverted commas, that we kind of like to always go on about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, of course. And even an argument like that relies on the idea that women are hormonal and men aren't. And of course, that's not true. And so it's probably, like many things, one of these tricky things where there's a mixture of different factors going on. But I thought that's interesting. And one of the common criticisms of these kind of statistics that compare prevalence in men and women is the idea of, is it that one gender is getting diagnosed more?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because this stat is based on number of diagnoses. It's not really possible to get a perfect gauge of how many people have something outside of how many people have been diagnosed with that.
Well, absolutely. And after I gave birth to my second child, I was feeling a little bit low one day and a bit emotional when the health visitor came, knocked on the door. And within 5 minutes, she said to me, I think maybe you might have postnatal depression. And I was like, well, I don't think I have. And that wasn't because I was in denial or because there's any stigma attached to it, because I'd 100% own it and know it's a real condition and it's something that we need to address. But there was no other evidence to suggest that. I mean, it hadn't been going on for a long time. You know. But I wonder, as some of the research that I've looked at described, again, whether there's discrimination in that. You know, would a man be asked that question quite soon after saying, you know, oh, I'm just feeling a bit like this, feeling a bit like that, would that straight away be seen as potentially you're experiencing some postnatal depression, even though you're not biological, you know, you haven't given birth. It's a factor in men too. So that always interests me. And I've always gone back to that thinking, wow, this is a woman as well. Kind of expected a little bit more before we went down that route, you know.
But then maybe that's part of how common that experience is. That maybe they're able to recognise it very quickly in the way that you're not used to. You know, you're used to diagnoses in a GP being preceded by far more questions, whereas maybe when you're dealing with people in the specific situation of just having a kid, you sort of know the signs, whereas a GP sees people from all kinds of life scenarios.
Yeah, maybe, Bob, but there was still an intention to get a label out there quickly and kind of put this thing, say that this may be what we're going through really quickly. It was the speed in which I just wanted to probably talk to someone, have a chat. Oh, I think I felt even worse about how I was feeling, actually. And I was fine. And I don't think I experienced postnatal depression. And I'm lucky in that way. But yeah, I know what you mean. There's two sides to it, I guess.
Well, I guess for you, it was probably quite a jarring experience that you were sharing how you were feeling and then you were sort of very quickly being given this label and the conversation, by the sounds of it, kind of ended. You know, whereas actually, irrespective of whether or not the diagnosis was accurate, you just kind of wanted someone to talk to, not be like, oh, you've just got this, on to the next thing. But no, you're right, and it is a tricky thing. We did a whole episode about postnatal depression with the campaigner that successfully got support for men who experienced that condition in the NHS for the first time ever. So you can find that in our back catalogue. I'll link it as well. And I've got a stat from the Australian organisation Raising Children, who reported that up to 1 in 10 men experience antenatal or postnatal depression. And much of that is linked to hormonal changes that happen for men around the birth of a child, which many people don't realise even happens. But among other things, our testosterone levels go down. But you're right, it is so common. So Another stat we've got is that a recent study found that as many as 1 in 7 women may experience postpartum depression up to a year after childbirth. And even in the short time that we've been running this podcast, you know, coming up on 3 years now, I've seen how those stats have escalated. Even in that time period, the estimates for prevalence of postnatal depression keeps going up. And so hopefully that's part of the good side, that it's being recognised more and it's being taken seriously that women are struggling with this, rather than being like, oh, you know, having a child's difficult, you'll be fine. You know, kind of dismissing what can be real struggle that needs additional support.
I know those statistics come from different research, but, you know, 1 in 7 and 1 in 10, female and male, are similar. And people would be surprised to that. And again, that contributes to the stigma. Those statistics are quite similar, and surprisingly so. You know, 1 in 7 and 1 in 10.
Yeah, for the statistic specifically for men, that's the highest prevalence I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And, you know, it probably is linked to more recognition of how broad the effects of this condition can be. Mm. And maybe partly a cultural change as well, that there are more expectations in our generation than perhaps a few generations ago of the role that a man plays in raising a child, an expectation for them to be more hands-on.
Absolutely, and that's where we're trying to get to, aren't we, in terms of this level playing field and expectations for everybody as human beings, because I've just bought my friend a book, and I bought it for her and her partner. They've just had a baby, and it's about sleep training. Sorry, listeners, to those who are kind of baby-led parenting. And somebody said to me, why have you addressed it to both of them? And I was like, excuse me? But how? Oh, just really innocently, how come you've addressed it to both of them and gave the name of both of the couple? I understand the present and the card, but the book obviously is specifically for her. And I was like, hello, is this 2020? Because all I know is my man was sharing that sleeping business with me. Now, I know women breastfeed, so again, it may come back to some of those biological things that in the night, woman gets up and breastfeeds the baby. But even so, like, my guy was up with me, like, we're in this together because this baby's half yours, mate. So there's this expectation again that this book should be for the woman, you know, about sleeping and training the baby in those early days. And I'm just like, so like, not down for that.
Yeah. And in the simplest sense, the baby crying wakes the whole house up. You know, you can have a previous kid in the house. They're getting woken up too.
Absolutely.
You know, so of course it affects everyone. But yeah, it depends on the kind of expectations in the household of whose role it is. And I've known couples where the woman's, you know, expressed milk, and then they completely take it in turns. And they're like, well, you've got a bottle. You go ahead. It's your turn tonight.
It's your turn. And I understand that, again, in general, I would say most women, and we know by law, get longer to have be off work. Maternity leave is longer for women, and men get this 2-week shit that's meant to do something for them, and then men go back to work. Generally, let's say, it doesn't happen, of course, in lots of situations. So there are some kind of norms, maybe socially and legally and environmentally, that biologically, that lead to this way of leaning over toward the woman for that and man for that a bit. But we've got to just change the narrative, so that's just not an expected thing within families, that you can question, oh, how are you guys raising it? What's happening in your situation, as opposed to just this expectation of gender roles? That's where we want to get to.
Yeah, it covers all sorts of things. You know, babies are quite a good example. And I think this might even be something we touch on in terms of like gendering toys in the interview, you know, but we talk about it all the time with the like idea of blue and pink. You know, because I was a baby boy, I must like blue. I do actually love blue. So, you know, prediction was accurate, but it's not definitive, you know. But yeah, it's just these kind of expectations that there's not necessarily anything nefarious in it, but it's social norms. And we're within our rights to question those sometimes. Hannah Gadsby has a good joke about it in her Netflix special. She says something along the lines of, people think I'm very weird about gender and I overthink it. What I think is weird is putting a pink headband on a bald baby.
Yeah, that is so true. But yeah, people do it. It's just this thing. And of course, we've got same-sex relationships going on here. We've got men raising kids together and women raising kids together. So, you know, we've got to just figure out these expectations and how we talk about who's doing what. Hopefully everyone's just sharing it all.
Yeah.
But we know that kind of doesn't happen. But no.
Yeah, it's not about confiscating the Barbies of the girls. It's just like, you can like Barbies, you don't have to like Barbies. That's the difference.
Yeah, that is exactly, that is it. That's the point. My daughter said to me once when we saw a guy in heels, she was about 4. Mummy, why is that boy wearing high heels? He's wearing girls' shoes. And I was just like, it's just not. It's just wearing a pair of shoes. Like, if he wants to wear those shoes, that's up to him. And if she wants to wear, and when Rhea loves blue, her middle name's blue, thinks blue, and questions around, oh, but blue at school, they say this and they say, you know, blue's for boys. And but I know it's not, because it's my middle name, so how can it be? You know, it's just trying to, like you said, like, it doesn't matter what you want to do. Do whatever you want. Just try not to prescribe to that. That's for that and that's for that. That's where these problems then escalate and do impact on us and our mental health as we grow older.
Yeah, I've got another comedian example, actually. You can tell that I've been doing a lot of research for our new dating podcast about comedians.
Plug, plug.
Yeah, dating games coming up soon. But obviously interviewing a lot of comedians on that. But Eddie Izzard even has a joke about that where he says, these aren't women's heels, they're my heels. I own them.
Yeah, love that.
So anyway, we've gone slightly off on a tangent. Let me see what else we had stats-wise. The final stats we'll delve into are, of course, relating to the suicide rate. So this is something that's brought up a lot when people talk about gender and mental health, specifically how high rates of suicide are in men, which, of course, is often linked to narrow ideas of masculinity, that men can't show emotions, men can't get help because they might be labelled weak because of that. The stat from the BBC I often mention is that for men under the age of 50, suicide is the biggest killer. And that's one that particularly hits home for me, not only as a man, but someone that has experience of mental ill health. I'm already familiar with the particular struggles that are the biggest risk to my mortality.
Yeah.
It's a stat we hear all the time, but it's a sobering one and worth pausing on. And what you often don't hear in addition to that stat is that the highest prevalence of suicide in the UK is actually men aged 45 to 59. So once you get to 50, that doesn't mean actually your risk goes down. Your risk actually goes up a little bit more, but it's just that other conditions take over as a higher risk.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. There was some more in that research that was literally a sentence between them about how interesting it is that then women's mental illness in women is more prevalent, yet suicide in men is more prevalent.
So the stat, yeah. I'm glad you brought it up. So that's from Science Direct. Women are twice as likely to be diagnosed with major depression and yet are 1/4 as likely as men to take their own lives.
There it is.
And even within that, there's another stereotype. So often, and this is something I really grew up with, this mentality of men get depression and women get anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I've never had a need to research depression relating to gender before. So not until reading this did I even know that more women were diagnosed with depression. Somewhere along the line, I'd got kind of caught up in the stereotype myself. And that can happen to all of us. And it's really worrying, because if I can get caught up with it as a man, surely so many women can get caught up with it as well and think, oh, no, I probably don't have depression. That's generally men that get that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet getting the right diagnosis can be really important with getting the right support, the right medication.
Yeah, and that's interesting, because I think then men seem, maybe because of that, more accepting of the fact that they may have depression or experience depression as opposed to experiencing anxiety. You know what I mean?
And again, like, I can see the link there with gender expectations as well, that anxiety, a lot of people think about in terms of being a worrier, you know, and that's often stereotyped on women. That women are worriers, that mums are worriers, that it's a very gendered thing to worry, and yet it's human to worry.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something we're really looking forward to exploring in this two-part series. So, and before we get into introducing our guest, who we are so excited to have got to chat to, we'll just briefly mention a few other things we've got around World Mental Health Day, including some fun podcast appearances. So on Saturday, World Mental Health Day itself, I'm appearing on the Pod Bible podcast. It's a show all about podcasting, and they especially did one on mental health. And I got to talk all about my experience of speaking up about my own mental health, talking about the community online and the community within podcasting, of people also sharing their experience and how transformational that's been, how much I've learned, but also how much we've been able to see progress through these conversations. So that one, very excited about. And then as of today, I also have an episode coming out on the In The Moment podcast with Alex Manzi, who's a previous guest. We did an episode all about happiness, and that's a major theme of his podcast, as well as all kinds of angles on talking about mental health. And I share a lot about my background, but we also really delve into stigma and the kind of the flaws in stigmatizing attitudes and the ideas around self-care being selfish and all these things that progress is being made on, but there's still work to be done. So yeah, so really great conversation. We're big fans of him here at Mental. And then the last one, which actually isn't this week, but I don't think we've mentioned yet, is you going on your first ever podcast as a guest.
On Fitter, Healthier Dads. It was brilliant because that podcast focuses a lot on physical health of dads. So I guess guys of a certain age, maybe around maybe that 40 mark, and their health. And Darren, the host, was like, you know, if we've got an umbrella of health, we need some episodes around mental health, which was great that he recognised that. So I appeared on his podcast, which was fantastic. And we talked a lot about the links between mental health and physical health. And again, reducing that the stigma for men when it comes to dealing with their mental health in order to live a more holistically healthy lifestyle. So it was fantastic. So yeah, go check that out. Fitter, Healthier Dads.
You did so brilliantly. I was so proud of you.
Oh, brilliant. I loved it.
It's so exciting when you have a guest slot related to you that's not actually you. And I'm not sat there analysing what I said. But you did brilliantly. So we'll put the link to all of those down in the episode description. And now let's talk about our guests. So this week we're speaking to Juno Dawson, an incredible author, mainly of young adult fiction, but also of non-fiction work, including an incredible book called Gender Games, all about gender. And someone that I really look up to in terms of her intellect in this area. So it was a really great conversation. We covered even broader perspective than I was even guessing we would. So yeah. First part of our two-part series. Anything you want to add?
Well, just to back up what you said, actually, I thought Juno was absolutely fantastic. I really enjoyed listening. And like you said, we covered so many different things. I think we could have carried on talking for hours, couldn't we? You were like, we're going to have to end it now. But really worth listening to. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it.
Brilliant. So we'll get into that episode with Juno Dawson in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name is Juno Dawson. I think my first experience of mental illness, but not necessarily recognizing it as mental illness, was when I was about 10 or 12 years old, and we were on a family holiday to Mallorca, and we were out after dinner and we got horribly lost trying to find our way back to the hotel. And I had what I would now call a panic attack. Really, from that point onwards, anxiety has been a feature of my life. Maybe not the defining feature of my life, but certainly it has had an impact.
And I think that's a common experience for most people, particularly as young people with the lack of education and the amount of stigma. We just grapple with it and try and put a label that's the closest. So for me, my depression, I thought was loneliness, because that's the nearest thing I understood. And so during that experience, were there other ways in which your anxiety came out? And were they generally related to getting lost, or was there other factors?
I think initially there was like an underlying feature of sort of taking steps into independence. I wasn't a very independent adolescent at all, really. I didn't really like doing things by myself and I was quite sheltered. But the thing with anxiety, and I think for me, the difference between worry and anxiety is when it really just kind of becomes about nothing. as I went into adulthood, there were obvious valid concerns and valid worries. You know, who wouldn't be worried about their exams and who wouldn't be worried about their driving test or the future or getting a job? But in the end, as I got older, it kind of just became this sort of like underlying dread about nothing, you know. And that's what's even more frustrating, because it would be, you know, it'd be so simple if you could go to the GP and sort of say, look, I'm really worried about this. But it doesn't work like that. And still to this day, even though I'm 39 years old, you know, I still have real issues around travel. I find travel really hard. I find being outside of my comfort zones really, really difficult. I mean, thankfully, my comfort zone is much bigger than it used to be when I was 12 and I live a fabulous life. But one example, last year, I was sent on an assignment with a magazine to the most ridiculous luxury resort in Thailand. And on one hand, I couldn't, you know, fully appreciate, oh my God, I'm literally in paradise. But actually, that whole week, I was just a hot mess. You know, I couldn't relax for a second. I was so worried about how we were going to get places, what we were going to do. My anxiety is very tied in with my IBS as well. I think IBS and anxiety are basically the same thing for me. So my anxiety makes me quite physically sick as well. And yeah, and it's so frustrating. And then you can really beat yourself up as well, because you're like, oh my God, I should really be enjoying this 5-star resort. But I'm not. I'm just freaking out the whole time. I personally don't separate mental illness from illness. They are all illnesses that happen within my body somewhere. And so it is, I think it's just about trying to sort of strive towards the best possible overall health at any given point.
Yeah. And I think that is the place we'll probably arrive at ultimately, because it's like almost day by day, we're realizing just how difficult it is to separate mental health and physical health. The terms are just becoming quite redundant at this point.
I hope so. I mean, that was when sort of the penny dropped for me, when I went to my GP to talk about the physical side of my illness, which was, I basically had a massive, massive panic attack at a big literary festival called the Hay Festival, where I had just had the mother of all IBS attacks minutes before I was due to go on stage. And I was kind of like, well, fuck this. You know, I've worked so hard in my career. I'm not going to let IBS derail my job. So I went to the doctor and I was quite stroppy in the nicest possible way. And I was like, look, I've had enough of this. I want you to now cure me of IBS. And I'm not leaving your office until you do. And he was like, well, actually, I'm going to put you on a mild antidepressant. And I was like, I'm sorry, I think you've misheard. You know, I'm here about IBS. And he was like, no, we increasingly think it's like a mental complaint. We think, you know, it's worrying yourself sick. So we're going to try you on a mild anxiety drug. And lo and behold, it worked. So there you go.
I think that's really true. And I definitely know that from a member of my family, where it's very clearly correlated. And for us, it's also travel, that he'll, whenever we're going somewhere, he's normally the one that likes to be in charge of the travel, but he also finds it quite stressful, you know, maybe feels a certain level of responsibility to always know where everything is, even in a city that's not at all his. And, you know, it definitely impacts physical health.
And it's also, it messes with your life as well. You know, it's a limiting, it's a life limiting condition, in that, similar to your friend, I think I, you know, like to know what's what. I like to know I'm going to feel safe. Otherwise, the anxiety around the trip almost makes it not worth it. About to go on holiday in a couple of weeks, COVID allowing. And I'm not particularly concerned about that, because I've been to the Greek islands numerous times. I know exactly what's what. It feels like a familiar and safe environment. Whereas there was something about that big, very long haul trip to Thailand that felt very unfamiliar, which was irrational. But then anxiety is not rational.
I love the way you mentioned that earlier as well, coming to terms with just how unrelated it can be from what's actually going on. I think that's something that a lot of people really grapple with. And I think there's a parallel there with the way you've come to understand gender, that as time's gone on, you've learnt more and more how much of it is just made up.
Yeah, I think gender, your identity full stop, is something that you spend your whole life grappling with. As you get older, you've spent more time in your skin, I think. So you kind of settle into yourself. And I hope I continue to do that as I sort of head into middle age as well. And you do just sort of feel less at odds with the world in general. I think a lot of my 20s, in lots of different ways, felt quite combative. I felt at odds with the world that I was in. And you know, the best thing that I could do to fit into this world was to transition. But I think that's something that can be said of a lot of people, which is, you know, in what form can you best exist in this world? And I think that's something that everybody contends with, regardless of whether they're cis or trans.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that we tackle all the time with mental health stigma, that we understand on the podcast enough about mental health to know how ridiculous the stigma is. But at the same time, it still exists and we still have to navigate it. And it's kind of like that with gender, that there are these expectations, and whether or not there's logic to a lot of them, they still exist and they feel very real to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think society is disappointing in lots of ways. It's like we live in a society that is going to disappoint us. And, you know, even we've come so far, 2020, you still go into these toy shops or these kids' clothing stores and you see that everything is pink or blue and everything is very divided down the middle. And I do think, as someone who was a trans kid and then a trans adult and also a primary school teacher, we do put a lot of expectation on children. You know, as soon as you are told whether or not you're going to have a boy or a girl, there's lots and lots. And it's really fascinating. When I was writing my book, The Gender Games, I read lots of sociological and psychological research about the ways that parents and carers treat children, limiting ways that girls can do less. They are more protective of girls. They don't let girls play independently the same way that they let boys play independently. They allow boys to take risks more than they allow girls to take risks. And there's lots and lots of evidence backing these things up. And I think it goes further than parents as well. I think society treats boys and girls differently. And so we're all dealing, all of us, again, whether you're trans or whether you're not trans, we're all operating in a system that is very, very gendered. And it goes all the way into adulthood as well, you know, with people asking women but not men if they intend to have children. Victims of catcalling are nearly always women. Victims of sexual assault are overwhelmingly women. There's something wrong with the system, not necessarily individuals. Hopefully, we're all working towards changing that. And in my mind, the tool for changing sexism in society is feminism.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's a really great distinction, that this is something that you mention in your book, that actually gender expectations benefit nobody. They harm all of us.
And oh, yeah, 100%. Whenever I do a podcast, I always state right up front, you know, I do not speak on behalf of the trans community. There is no monolithic trans community, but I can speak from experience. And I know that my parents thought they were protecting me by making me act as much like a boy as possible and training me to behave like a boy. But of course, as soon as you examine that, the whole thing just falls to pieces, because what on earth does a boy behave like? It's a completely abstract notion of masculinity. And unfortunately, that I think that notion of masculinity leads us sweetly back to mental health as well, because of course a lot has been said about men not wanting to speak up for fear is being seen as weak or failures. I think a lot of the conversations we have around mental health ultimately do lead back to gender as well, especially when it comes to men and mental health. We were just talking about Sex and the City before we started recording. You know, culturally, women are encouraged to talk to other women. You know, it's seen as a positive thing when, whether you look at Little Women or Sex and the City or the Spice Girls, that sense of sisterhood is actively encouraged by our culture. Whereas with men, that's not something we've seen until very, very recently, like within the last 10 years. Hopefully things will improve though.
For sure. And it's this kind of demonizing of vulnerability with men that really annoys me, and the irony of it, that actually there's such power to vulnerability, and many people, including a lot of men that feel very in a stranglehold with their own emotions, find other people's vulnerability quite intimidating. You know, there's that really harsh contrast.
And that's also a British cultural thing. I think, you know, when you spend time with Americans, their vocabulary around mental health is immediately better and immediately more open than the way we approach it in this country anyway, where there is still this very kind of like strange diff upper lip thing, which we really struggle to move away from. It's maddening. Similarly as well, I think women are encouraged as well to be carers and put their needs behind those of their children as well. So, and again, so that comes again, once again, back to gender. So those assumptions, we start them in childhood, they can lead and feed into quite serious mental health issues later on.
Yeah. When you look back at your experiences now, would you mind sharing some examples of how there were expectations put on you in terms of what it is to behave like a boy?
It's funny, I mean, I would love to say that it was a nice, easy correlation, but it's such a big thing. One of my favourite misconceptions is that, you know, trans people just hop out of bed one morning and are like, surprise, bitch, I'm a girl now, as if it is like a whim. As soon as I knew the difference between boys and girls, like, I was like, well, I'm a girl, like, duh. It really wasn't a thinker, but you know, I grew up in a world that was not ready for trans people. And that is fucked. And it's really oppressive. And I think if anything good has been achieved in this cursed year, it's that we are now finally having conversations around Black Lives Matter, around anti-Semitism, around ableism, around trans lives, around LGB lives as well. And some people are reacting very badly to those conversations, but I like to think the vast majority aren't necessarily getting involved, but are listening, are watching diversity do their big thing about Black Lives Matter on Britain's Got Talent, and are like, huh, interesting, okay, I'm listening. And recognising that, again, it's the system. The system has been designed for one type of person, and it is largely an able-bodied, cisgender, straight, white man. And the world works best for those men. And if you're not one of those men, the world doesn't quite fit you. We're not designed to help working mums back into the workplace. The world is not designed to have two men or two women be in a relationship. The world is not designed for Black people to not be seen in a stereotypical or pejorative way. And the world similarly isn't designed at the moment for trans people. So of course, growing up in this world felt shit because it wasn't made for me. So everything was just that little bit harder. Yeah.
And the crazy thing I have to remind myself about is actually when you list out those traits, those people aren't actually the majority. They just ended up with the majority of power.
As somebody who used to be a teacher, it's embarrassing to me now that when I sat down and looked at those schemes of work, the history scheme of work, the geography scheme of work, the religious study scheme of work, I didn't think, who are others? You know, who put this in place? You know, when you're, you know, these lovely twee kind of units of work about the golden age of the Victorian Empire, and you're like, oh, they left out some plot details, you know? And it's frustrating that as a teacher, I didn't think to challenge that, although I guess I would have probably lost my job. But, you know, where was the queer history? But, you know, if the world had been different, and if the world continues to become different, because I think the world is a shit show at the moment, we could, through education, make the world readier, you know, for people, so we wouldn't be so at odds with our environment.
Yeah, and a lot of that is a big part of the mental health education campaigning we do, just seeing how many obvious parts of day-to-day lives people aren't taught about. We're taught all kinds of things that don't apply when you're an adult, and you're told they will, and it's one of the biggest lies. And then there's so much that you just don't learn. You have to figure it out by yourself. And then we wonder why people struggle to get support for mental health, or why they can struggle with symptoms for so long before getting help. Well, you know, I was never even taught what the symptoms were. So of course, I just thought there was something innately wrong with me that I had to suppress and pretend I was okay about.
I think a lot of roads lead back to education. The way we interact with our environment is so vital for our mental health. And I think as much as maths lessons are really helpful, you might sense from my tone, I don't think they're that helpful. You know, I think teaching young people how to navigate society, even things like, you know, how to use money, you know, how to save up, you know, things like this that have such a huge impact further down the line on your mental health would be so valuable. I think we have a real opportunity within the education system. You know, prevention is better than cure. That's the trick we're missing. The NHS is doing the best it can do with the funding it gets. But what if we tackled this problem before people even got to the NHS? To my mind, that's the most powerful tool that we have, education.
I agree. And I think what you've said there really applies to all subjects, is they all have to be practical. You know, that we're not saying ban maths, we're saying maths should relate to the grown-up lives of the children you're teaching.
You're meant to. A primary, I will say this as a former teacher, you are meant to teach maths within context, but it doesn't always quite work out like that. There is room in there, and I think we need the government to empower teachers. It all trickles down from the top. It's a governmental issue. It's on their front step, clapping for carers.
Yeah, well, I've certainly seen a lot of artists paralleling with being paid in exposure.
Yeah, thank it's you. Like trying to clap at the till in Tesco. Do you accept claps?
And I think one of the things our conversation so far is highlighting is just how interconnected gender is and mental health is, but also so many other issues. And I think this is a big part of why it can feel a lot easier to just go along with the expectations in place. Because once you start questioning gender or you start questioning mental health stigma, you find that it links to so much else that needs to change in our society.
I think LGBTQ plus people, you're slightly damned if you do, damned if you don't. So if you remain in the closet, we know that's incredibly detrimental to mental health. You know, sneaking around, keeping secrets, hiding facets of your personality is traumatic. And the flip side of coming out is traumatic. Because, again, I don't want to victim blame, and I think we need to take the onus off the queer person and actually put it on the closet. That is causing trauma. It's every time you turn on the TV, you know, you are going to be watching minutes and minutes worth of adverts that feature people and couples that don't really look like you. You know, we're being told so subliminally that you are abnormal. How, of course, that has a detrimental effect on your mental health. And it takes a real maturity to remove yourself from the environment and recognize, oh, I'm fine.
There's a real parallel there for me that you call it the closet, but I might be more likely to refer to it as the stigma, in that there's that similar pressure to keep quiet about your mental health, you know, not disclose diagnoses. And then you have the whole debate of whether or not, you know, people at work should know. And so often people are hiding parts of themselves that can be really integral to how you deal with them and how you support them. But we still live in a world where so often it can feel unsafe to be honest about these things.
And it doesn't help that some people can be real dickheads about birth things. You know, there are still people who love nothing more than having a gossip. It's about mental health, which is, oh, he's off with depression. Oh, has he tried cheering up? That's something that I think we could all, you know, after the death of Caroline Flack, you know, people, you know, it was all like, oh, how awful. You know, as if they'd never in their lives criticised somebody else, you know, for the state of their mental health. So it's kind of people, there is a bit of innate hypocrisy in all of us. And, you know, I've done it as well. I think, you know, I'm not claiming to be a saint. We all need to recognise the role we play in stigmatising as well as being aware of the stigma itself.
Yeah. And so much of this we sort of come pre-built with. You know, and that's why it can be so uncomfortable, because to question notions of stigma or gender expectations or any kind of discriminatory attitudes is also to question so much of how our kind of default outlook in the world can be.
And certainly growing up in the North as well. I mean, I remember, so obviously depression was invented in the 90s, as we all know, just like Caitlyn Jenner invented being trans. And, you know, I remember a friend's dad having some time off work with depression. Like, spoiler alert, he was not treated sympathetically. It was not good. And it came from, again, a lack of education, issues around masculinity. Like, he was meant to be the breadwinner. Oh my God, who is going to earn Monday if he's not working? It's all very interconnected. Life would be so much easier if everything was a straight line, but it's not. It's like a big ball of elastic bands all in a big knot. And at the heart of it is the individual. You know, it's quite easy to dehumanize people when we talk about statistics. You know, when we talk about the fact that nearly half of trans youth have tried to kill themselves, that's a scary number, but it's a number, you know, and it's very hard to imagine. But what we're talking about is someone's kid, you know, someone's son or someone's daughter, someone's sibling. And that's something that even as kind of mental health campaigners, we've got to be very wary that at the end of the day, we are all just people. And that's what I hate. I really hate about this notion of the trans community, because it's just people, just humans, you know, who work in the post office or at a car door delivery drivers. You know, these are people with lives. And that can be a weird symptom of conversations around our lives.
Yeah. Well, so often I think that term is used in a way to imply some kind of conspiracy, like trans people are personally coming to destroy gender, when actually they are perhaps in many ways the people that understand best how much gender doesn't serve us. And so quite rightly, they understand the need to question it. But, you know, that's something that plenty of groups question. And to a degree, I think all of us do. You know, I think every person, even from a very young age, has had that experience of gender being put on them, a certain expectation that they didn't fit. What do you do with that?
There's nothing you can do. I mean, as we've gotten older, a lot of my friends who, in my head, I still feel I'm about 16, but I'm not, I'm old. And a lot of my friends are now parents. And it's been really amazing to see them parent with more awareness of how damaging gender norms can be. And just kind of letting their kids just be, with sort of free from judgment, free from steering them, letting them like the things they like. There's that whole campaign, let toys be toys, just let kids play with the things they like, let kids wear what they want to like. And just that's such a big part of childhood, that freedom. You know, adulthood is so rubbish that I think it's just really cool to just let kids be kids. All families should be talking about gender, because it's so huge, especially if you have girl babies. You know, those girl babies are stepping out into a world which is kind of fundamentally misogynist. It's so important to empower girls and, you know, to really say, you know, look at these amazing women who've achieved amazing things, both in the modern times and in history. We want empowered young girls to become empowered women who become CEOs and politicians and leaders. Because, again, if we look at this cursed year, the countries which seem to have fared best in this mess have been the ones with female leadership. I don't know how I got onto that from a conversation about mental health, but we do need more female leaders.
No, I love it. But you're really proving the point of it all just being so interconnected. You know, it's a really difficult conversation at times, because to many people it can feel like you're questioning them and, you know, they're oftentimes good intentions. But I remember even from a young age, and this is as someone who is cisgender, who identifies as male and always has done, I still remember, you know, seeing trends of when people told me as a little boy, good boy, it tended to be for very specific behaviours. And so there were certain things like, you know, I did a GCSE in cooking. I was never told that related to my gender. That was just something that I did, whereas other things were reinforced via gender. I think it's important for all of us to examine how much we rely on gender and how much we put it into situations where perhaps it isn't relevant. And an easy example I often give people with that is we've all made the mistake with someone's pet. Like for me, growing up, I had a pet cat with my parents who happened to be female. And so I would often just see someone else's cat and just ask, what's her name? And actually, you know, it seems like such a small thing, but it's an example of where gender gets inserted all the time. The obvious thing would be, I'd say, what's the cat's name? or what's your cat's name?
Oh, God, yeah. And people are so horrified if you get their pet's gender wrong. People really freak out about that. Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize. I'm like, calm down. Yeah, it permeates everything we do, you know, and that's the other thing. So we get these straw man arguments, you know, so Juna Dawson, sort of like author, I will say, you know, in my articles, I think we need to be more mindful of gender. 5 minutes later, someone has retweeted saying, oh, so you think we should scrap gender? And I'm like, nobody is saying that. That's something else that's certainly true of stigma around mental health as well, which is, you know, when we see mental health being talked about in the press, still it's, you know, it's kind of, they still do it. You know, whenever there's been like some sort of like big sort of like incident, you know, some sort of like criminal incident, they always say, you know, who did have mental health problems. And you're kind of like, well, I have mental health problems, but we're not out killing people. So I think there's a real value in being highly critical of the press in order to get through modern life. I think it's really important to question the things we read, especially in the tabloids.
Yeah. But also, I think that's such a reflection of the kind of clickbait media we're so used to on social media nowadays, that you can write a really detailed think piece that's very well articulated, but there is this pressure to condense that down to one line. And when it comes to issues around mental health, so rarely is that even possible. And so no wonder people don't bother reading the article. Mm. They just click and they share.
Just, I mean, so much whataboutery as well, kind of just, well, what about this? And well, what about that? And it's so hypothetical. And it's so removed. And again, it puts an extra onus on you as the individual, you know, and I think that's true of mental health as well, which is, I'm not a doctor. And yet you're expected to know almost medical levels, you know, and I'm not an expert. I'm a children's author.
I know. And I come across that all the time. And it's just so maddening because people are expected to be able to perfectly articulate their mental health, something that affects in many cases their ability to think and communicate when they're at their worst. You know, it's just so ironic. And something I could definitely recommend to the listeners is, I've worked very hard to get better at spotting when it's a conversation, you know, that someone isn't really trying to understand. And one of the ways you can catch that out is by trying to recommend a resource to them. You know, you can recommend a book or a particular charity where they can learn more. And generally, if they're not really interested in learning, they're going to be very closed off to that. Yeah. And that's a great way to catch people out. And at that point, I will, for the sake of my own mental health, often remove myself from the conversation and say, you know, the resources are out there.
I mean, I don't do this sort of stuff as much as I used to anymore for that reason, which is, I realised, you know, I came out publicly about 6 years ago, and I realised that in those 6 years, I've been having the same conversations a lot, which suggests to me that people either don't want to move on, or that they quite like having us kept in these same spots, you know, kind of having the same conversations time and time again. And actually, increasingly, I let my work speak for itself. But I'm very, very fortunate in that I have a platform as an author. I both write novels and nonfiction. I don't need to be arguing on social media about my gender or my mental health or any element of my life, because I'm very fortunate that I have the opportunity to be able to express myself through my work. And that's why increasingly I'm living argument free. I don't want to spend the rest of my life arguing.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's something that really concerns me, particularly on social media, making people hypothetical. And I think it happens to the trans community to an extent, which it happens to few others, where it's easy to debate something that is hypothetical to you because you've maybe never knowingly had a conversation with a trans person.
It's like, I don't know what it's like to not have gender dysphoria. I don't know what it's like to live in a world where you don't have to go through this transition to be who you are, because, you know, for the first 30 years I was dreaming of being a woman, and then I set about doing it. So this has affected my whole life. It's so weird. It's so fundamental to everything you are. But what I ask is that people listen. It doesn't need to be a debate. It just is. We didn't always call it transgender. That came in about the 50s. But you know, there's records of us going back to ancient Greek times. I don't think there's an argument to be had. If you want to know about my experience, by all means, I will share it, but I'm not going to debate it.
I think there's such power to that. And the thing I really wanted to add to that is your point about understanding. And I would say there's no necessity to understand in order to have respect for somebody. And that 100% goes for mental health. I do not have personal experience of most of the mental illnesses we cover here on the show, but hopefully the show goes as far as to prove that that does no way inhibit your ability to have a conversation and support someone in sharing their story.
So empathy, just empathy and compassion, and trying to understand somebody else's life, even though they've lived a very different life to you, that takes a bit more work and also a bit more time.
For sure. And in terms of your experience nowadays, how do you find gender still plays a role in your life? And does that relate to your mental health at all at this point?
Yeah. I mean, it's the same old. You know, I'm still trans and I'm going to be trans forever. And so nowadays, you know, I potter around in the world, in a world that reads me as a woman. But the downside of that, of course, is that, you know, very early on I started to experience, so the transphobia started to fade. And as the transphobia faded, the misogyny started. So just a couple of weeks ago, I got followed around Hove by some creepy man in a car who was asking me to get in a car with him. You know, I don't know many women that that hasn't happened to. So unfortunately, yeah, gender, misogyny, patriarchy, transphobia, those things are going to be a part of my life forever. There's a positive note to end on. Cheerful.
But I think it's honest, right? You know, it's better that you, I guess, acknowledge that then try and pretend that there is some magic endpoint where you're beyond gender and you no longer have to work on that or your mental health.
We can get better. I mean, so I suppose the next evolution in my life will be as a middle-aged woman. So, you know, there will be that point that many women have written about and talked about, that point of turning invisible, you know, where all of a sudden society doesn't read you as a sexual being anymore. And you can kind of, in a strange way, pass through society more. I mean, that's a conversation to perhaps have with an older woman, but so that's the next stage. You know, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, you know, are you happier? You know, almost as if kind of like, oh no, but it's such hard work. Was it a mistake? Do I ever have any regrets? And the answer is no, which is how I know I did the right thing. I'm not going to pretend that my life is better every day, all day. And, you know, you take your baggage with you. I was anxious before. I'm still anxious now, but I'm happier every day. You know, every day since I transitioned has been better. Not perfect, but better. And that's a much nicer note to end on. There we go. And end. There we go.
No, I totally agree. And I think that's the way I've really had to come to understand my own mental health journey, and 100% there's a link with happiness there, that I've had to work hard at learning that I can be happy along the way, that there is no magical end point where my life will be sorted. And, you know, that's the same for everybody. We can be sold this happily ever after narrative, and reality is that life is hard. And we do our best and we make mistakes, and it's better to do something about that mistake than beat yourself up about it. So we will wrap up there then. Was there any kind of final notes you wanted to say, or do you feel you've covered it?
No, I mean, if listeners have enjoyed this conversation, I cover a lot of these things in my book of essays, The Gender Games, which especially all that stuff about like the research I went into about the way we treat boys and girls, that's all detailed in The Gender Games. And as well, my YA book, Mind Your Head as well, which is just a handbook. So I know a lot of parents really, really worry about supporting their teenagers through school. And so about 5 years ago, I did a title called Mind Your Head, which is like a handbook for young people to reflect on their own mental health experiences.
I love that. And I can personally give a big endorsement to The Gender Games in that I read it a few years ago and found it incredibly impactful, and that I had never read a whole work about gender that felt just so accurate and so true for me. So even as a cisgender person that in many ways has felt relatively unbound by gender, you know, I was always a kind of emotional boy growing up. And so now being a man that has a mental health podcast, it sort of just fits what maybe people expected from me. but I still found there was so much value there and you'd clearly put in so much work.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. So go buy the Gender Games and find Juno all over the internet, making the world a better place.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.